Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are online, I'm told, 22 hours a day. What's this? Ooh, okay, excellent. We're online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. And now the portion of the show where we collect. We have a pail and a shovel, like with the sand. And we go through the sand that is the media, and we scoop up different things. Ooh, it's a seashell. Ooh, it's a syringe. Ooh, it's a most emailed story from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And we put that in the pail, we put the other things like that in the pail, all the most viewed and most emailed stories, and we call it the most. And now with our big pail of sand is editor Trish McKinney.
Ooh, it's a plumpy nut. That is was the number two term on Google Trends this morning when I woke up. It's since been pushed down a little bit by George Carlin, but people last night were watching 60 Minutes, apparently, and they did a story. Anderson Cooper did a story, which you pointed out he had originally done last fall, but it's about something called Plumpy Nut. Mm. And let me let him explain what that is. Can you play the clip, Manoli?
It's cheap, easy to make, and even easier to use. So what is this miraculous cure? It's a ready-to-eat, vitamin-enriched concoction called Plumpy Nut, an unusual name for a food that may just be the most important advance ever to cure and prevent malnutrition.
So it's this paste that's made of peanut butter, powdered milk, powdered sugar. It's enriched with vitamins and minerals, and they give it to malnourished children in Africa. Specifically, this report was about children in Niger. And in some cases, children who were on the brink of death are brought back. They can gain as much as a pound in about a day if they eat this stuff. So it's not given to, you know, not every child in this area is eligible for the Plumpy Nut paste, but Doctors Without Borders is administering it, and it's apparently kind of a miracle cure.
Mm-hmm. And they ask, well, what about peanut allergies?
I know.
The guy stares at Anderson Cooper, and whenever he asks, then they say, we're not really up to that problem
yet. Yeah, that's kind of a first world problem.
Yeah, we're hoping to get there one day. But no, there's actually something interesting there. They don't seem to have any peanut allergies. Ian.
Hey.
Hey, dude.
How's it going?
All right, pretty good. Gonna bring us down for a second.
Yeah, I have a most emailed from ABC. There's this old plantation house in Maryland that's owned by the Emery family, and nowadays it's just used as a hunting lodge, and Washington College there has access to it, and they assume that everything in it, the house has an attic, and the college had assumed that everything in it was just junk and that it wasn't that old. And the people that lived there, the Emery family, they were just pack rats, and it turns out there's all this stuff of real serious historical significance sitting next to, like, old receipts and junk and laundry bills. Students were taking a tour of the place, and they looked into some of the papers, and they found maps, letters, financial records, a lock of hair from 1801.
Holy moses.
All these bills of sale from slaves and crops, pre-Civil War. And, you know, this interesting story of this family, the Emery family had one son in the Union, one in the Confederacy. And there's stuff, apparently an aspect of slavery that isn't well known is the practice of renting your family slaves to a neighbor or to another plantation. And there's some sort of notes about that that historians are learning from. So there's this whole cornucopia of historically significant notes that they had no idea was there.
Fascinating.
Very cool.
I shall be the next one to go.
Go ahead.
This has been the most emailed story at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the PI. It's been on there for quite a while. Because Edith Macefield died last week.
Who's
now,
that?
Edith Macefield had gained notoriety because she has a tiny little house in the Ballard neighborhood of Seattle. It's like two stories, two bedrooms, really a small house you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And on either side of her tiny little house are these two high-rise construction projects. And in back of the little house, she is surrounded by tons of concrete, or was. And they offered her literally $1 million to sell her house, and she always said, I ain't selling! So they built around her.
Did you really say, I ain't selling?
Oh, yeah. I ain't selling!
That's actually her voice. That's amazing. How do you do that?
That's the one thing I could do, is channel Edith Macefield. Well, CBS went to try to go get an interview with her, and they didn't, but she did speak with the Seattle PI last October. She told what I thought were some fanciful tales. She speaks seven languages, raised 30-something orphans, once met Hitler. But that's fine. That's fine. She was a Secret Service agent. That's fine. That's fine. What we do know is that Edith did not sell. She stuck firm, no matter how many guys from the construction company tried to urge her to sell. And there she died in her home, as she lived in her home, in the tiny little home in Ballard. And she was on one of the, and she befriended everyone from the site, and she became a symbol for, I don't know.
Standing up
meeting,
to the man.
Meeting Hitler. Okay.
Laura Silver
Hi.
Hi there.
Good morning. Beware the blackbirds, especially if you're in Chicago.
Why? Who?
They're
what?
Not
huh?
so friendly. Bicyclists and pedestrians have been attacked. Here's what one woman said. She was a businesswoman talking on her cell phone, just walking down the street. She said, "Something just came down, pecked me in the head, took my hair, took her hair, and started
All of
flying
it?
Away." It's not clear how much hair it
gosh.
Took. So there's this nasty blackbirds.
These birds are like dive bombing people.
They are, exactly.
Have you seen this? It is hilarious, though. When I lived in San Francisco, we would sit outside this cafe, and there were these birds that lived in this tree right next to it, and it was nonstop entertainment to sit on this bench and watch passersby get totally dive bombed by these birds, and they'd be like, ah, ah, and then you laugh and enjoy a little shouting for it.
Little revenge for 4 and 20 of their brethren getting baked in that pie all those years ago.
Yeah, no kidding, but guess what the name of the principal offender is?
What?
Think of a guy who made a movie about birds.
Hitchcock?
Yeah. That's what they call him.
Oh, they call him everyone Hitchcock?
Funny, funny, aha.
And that is the number one viewed story at the Chicago Tribune. And Dan, what do you have?
I've got a most email here from Yahoo News. Tiny Shetland Island declares independence. That's right. The owner of a tiny island, the whole island, the Shetland Islands are way up north near Scotland. And the whole island is 2.5 acres. And this guy's the one resident of the island. He owns the island. He basically shipwrecked. His boat capsized there during an unsuccessful attempt to circumnavigate Britain. And he just...
Doesn't seem that hard.
What, shipwrecking or circumnavigating Britain?
Circumnavigating Britain. Yeah, Britain. It's not that big.
The Spanish Armada didn't manage to do it.
Yeah, well, they had some opposition other than a rock. Anyway, go ahead.
So he has declared independence. He is citing his claim dates back to a 15th century arrangement between the Norwegian King Christian and King James III of Scotland. And he wants this island to be considered a crown dependency, like the Channel Islands. But this whole thing got me thinking about that episode of The Family Guy, where Peter declares his house an independent nation because it's not on the map of Quahog, and he declares it to be Pretoria, an independent country, and then he stops following all the laws because he's a diplomat and he doesn't have to obey the laws, and he sings this hilarious song, and it goes like this.
Can't touch me. Can't touch me. Just like the bad guy from Lethal Weapon 2. I've got diplomatic immunity, so hammer, you can't sue. I can write graffiti, even jaywalk in the street. I can riot, loot, not give a hoot, and touch your sister's teeth. Can't touch me.
And so there's a little Family Guy action for you.
Yeah, I think the bad guy in Lethal Weapon 2, Arjun Rudd. We'll have to check that.
Okay.
Off the top of my head. You got a story for us?
Yeah, we got a most emails here from NPR.org. You know, with the price of gas going up and up and up, people are putting more and more weight on gas mileage when they buy new cars. But it turns out that the standard miles per gallon measurement is causing a lot of people to make a big math error when they calculate how much gas different cars might save them. Mm-hmm. One expert actually calls this the miles per gallon illusion. NPR's Christopher Joyce explains.
At Duke University in North Carolina, Richard Larrick studies how people decide what to buy. He says his best guinea pig is himself. Recently, his two-car family was trying to decide how to save money on gas. Should they replace their gas-guzzling minivan with a slightly more efficient station wagon? Or should they dump their fairly thrifty sedan and replace it with a super-efficient hybrid?
The improvement on the minivan to a station wagon just didn't look very impressive. It was like 18 miles per gallon up to 28 miles per gallon.
Just a 10-mile-per-gallon improvement.
And when we compared replacing a sedan, which was getting about 30 miles per gallon, with a hybrid that was very efficient that got 50 miles per gallon, that looked very impressive.
A whole 20-mile-per-gallon improvement. So, dump the sedan and get the hybrid, right? Wrong.
We did the math and realized we drive both cars about the same distance. We realized that 18 to 28 ends up saving twice as much gas as the 30 to 50 improvement.
How could that be? Well, Larrick calls it the miles per gallon illusion. It turns out that not every increase in miles per gallon saves the same amount of gas. In fact, if you trade in a 15 mile per gallon car for a 20 mile per gallon car, you'll save much more gas than if you go from a 35-mile-per-gallon car to a 40-mile-per-gallon car. That's because gas guzzlers use so much more gas per mile. So even a 5-mile-per-gallon improvement in a gas guzzler means a lot less gas used for every journey. If a car gets more miles per gallon in the first place, the gas savings from the same improvement are less.
And we worry that people have a kind of why bother reaction when they look at cars that get 12 mpgs and think about raising it to 15 mpgs. That doesn't look big enough, but it saves a lot of gas.
In fact, Larrick conducted two surveys asking people to make car comparisons. And sure enough, most of them chose a car with the biggest improvement in miles per gallon, not the one that actually saved the most gas. Larrick says if America wants to use less gas, the priority should be get the most inefficient cars off the road right away, not try to get everyone to buy a super-efficient hybrid. Larrick published his findings in the journal Science. A lot of the confusion would disappear, he says, if the U.S. did what the rest of the world does, that is, compare cars by how many gallons per mile they use. Larrick's car-buying decision then makes sense. Going from his minivan to a station wagon would save him 3.6 gallons of gas every 100 miles. Replacing the sedan with the hybrid would save only about half that.
I think it's useful reporting this fuel economy in gallons per mile, which I agree makes more sense.
David Green is an energy analyst at the Federal Department of Energy.
Especially when one is comparing vehicles for the kinds of things you want to do today, which is save money or reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Green says the government actually calculates gallons per mile when it sets fuel efficiency standards for American cars. He says consumers can do that too at a website, www.fueleconomy.gov.
That's NPR's Christopher Joyce. You can get links to that and all the stories and the most by going to npr.org/Bryant Park.